Woohoo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
I think especially happy today. It's been, I feel like for us, this podcast is a sense of normalcy, a sense of community. And the last 24 hours, yeah, we've had the Boulder shooting that happened just a few miles down the road from where we are. 10 people were killed. And I think it just really hit heavy in our hearts, yeah. Thinking about the families that were impacted, thinking about the fact this is the 7th shooting in 7 days. Just a lot on our minds right now.
Yeah, layered on top of the Atlanta shooting last week and all the racial issues that brought up and how, you know, we learned from all of our friends about Asian hate and how they've been scared to go into grocery stores for years. And then now the shooting at a grocery store. So we're podcasting with very heavy hearts today. So we're gonna try to talk in an honest and open way for the first few minutes on this topic.
And I was gonna say, I think, you know, as we do that for the first few minutes, like if you feel like this conversation may incite trauma or just be hard for you to hear, like feel free to fast forward a few minutes. Like I think for us, it's really important that we're open and honest about this. I think, and especially too, as these events happen, it's so important to talk about the change that needs to happen too, but feel free to fast forward. Like if that's not what you're looking for today, we totally understand.
Yeah, it's the whole thing, like thoughts and prayers for sure. But thoughts and prayers so much. I remember Obama after Newtown in early 2010s talking about like, I'm just going to have to be up here all the time saying these same things. And, you know, seeing it down the street doesn't change the fact that this stuff has been happening so long and it's so fucked up. And, you know, it gets back to guns. It gets back down to policies. It gets down to basic empathy. And we're not experts on gun laws or guns in general. But we're going to talk from the doctor and lawyer perspective a little bit and what we know on that subject.
I think for me, what's so fascinating. So I've seen gunshot wounds in the hospital. I've seen them come into the ED. It's always horrifying, always terrible to see someone coming in with a gunshot wound. What I think to me is so fascinating though, is the American Medical Association takes a very clear stance on gun control. And the American Medical Association doesn't take a clear stance on a lot of things. And so that to me is telling. And I think it's because doctors see firsthand, you see people coming in with these horrible gunshot wounds and you see the sequela of these events happening. And it's truly terrible.
And it's a formal public health crisis from the American Medical Association is gun violence. And like, that's wild, especially when you start reading the quotes that motivated the expert quotes that motivated this proclamation from the American Medical Association. I was reading them for the first time today. You were telling me about them. And it just like caused my heart to just wrench thinking about like what this actually means.
I think the other thing too. So yesterday I was like scrolling through all the different news articles. And I think for me, my heart sunk the first time that I saw that an AR-15 was used in this mass shooting. It was just horrifying. I think to me, I've read so much research about AR-15s and how like what happens on like on a medical level and a cellular level when they're used against people. Also, I didn't know this, but in 2015, there's 1.2 million AR-15s made. That to me is bonkers, like totally bonkers. And I think just totally emphasizes the idea of the fact that like we really need gun control.
And but there's 15 million of them in US, like in the US.
That is sobering. That is so sobering. But I think, so I found this quote in the Journal of Trauma, and this is a little jarring, but I think it's jarring. And I think it's jarring in a way that like is helpful to understand and contextualize just why, like the true importance of why gun control is needed surrounding AR-15s. To compare again, a typical 9mm handgun wound to the liver will produce a pathway of tissue destruction in the order of 1 to 2 inches. In comparison, an AR-15 round to the liver will literally pulverize it, much like dropping a watermelon onto concrete results in the destruction of the watermelon. So I think, you know, these AR-15s, they have this fast muzzle velocity that actually like, it literally just destroys organs and tissues in the body in a way in which like handguns don't. And obviously like handguns aren't great either. But like the fact that we are manufacturing these on such a large scale is absolutely bonkers.
And they're so easy to get. And they're so easy to get in ways that are really hard to constrain legally. And I remember, so when I was in law school, DC v. Heller is the big Second Amendment case that codified some of these rights to assault weapons. And it was founded on the idea of originalism. So if you're listening to this, you might have heard of originalism. And it is as ridiculous as it sounds. It is interpreting the Constitution as the founders intended it at that exact moment. And that is really ridiculous because the founders would laugh at that notion. The whole idea of the Federalist Papers was creating a living document. At the time, the muskets were able to shoot you like one round every...
Cinnamon Toast Crunch didn't even exist in existence during the time of the Federalist Papers. I mean, think about that.
Prior to CTC, nothing counts in my book. And, you know, so DC v. Heller was written by Scalia, and originalism in that context was just used to justify a pre-existing policy condition. And that's why it's so intellectually disingenuous, because all you have to do is say, hey, what did the founders intend? And it just so happens to coincide with whatever you think they should have said.
And by the way, during the time in which the founders wrote this, women couldn't vote, slaves existed, Black people couldn't vote, like all these like bonkers things that are just...
the property of humans. And it's the most gross shit imaginable. And the fact that that is now applied to gun rights is so terrible. And, you know, there's an argument to be made. The Second Amendment didn't even think about private gun ownership. It was more thinking about militias. But even if you did say that, the founders would never want assault rifles in the hands of just whoever can get them day of, like the shooter did in Georgia. It is so, so deeply sad, especially when you combine it with that Journal of Trauma type article, which, you know, it's so, we all say thoughts and prayers, and it glosses over the reality of these broken, like humans as broken watermelons, that is just like right there at the surface. And, you know, that happens right down the street sometimes, but it shouldn't have to happen right down the street.
I was gonna say actually a really interesting thing to me, I think, is the public health and the like the public conception mm-hmm. of gun laws. So whenever you look at like public health data or public conception of gun laws, whenever there's a mass event like this, there's a spike in how people think about gun control in terms of like people supporting gun control. And that's largely irregardless of partisanship, which to me is fascinating. But I think like that to me is also confusing, because like, you know, if you're having this spike in terms of proximity to like mass shooting events, like where is the empathy for all of these other events that occur across the country? Like, why does it have to be that just like when it's in your backyard or like when it feels so tangible, that is when people support gun control?
Yeah. I mean, when it happened in an elementary school and it didn't lead to change, like we knew things were fucked up. And, you know, you look at Boulder, what happened here, Boulder passed an assault weapons ban. The NRA sued. It was subject to an injunction and prevented to go into effect. I'm not saying that that would have stopped this. I'm just saying that it gets to the point that if we can't even allow like municipalities to outlaw these killing machines, then what can we do? And the answer is we absolutely need policy, and we need to push on everything. Like, this is one of those topics that is not negotiable. We can't have people being able to get killing machines the day of, you know, whenever if they have background mental health or whatever. It's like, yes, that stuff exists in humans. That's why we need to control things like this and have like reasonable gun laws. We're not experts enough to argue the next step, right?
I think for me, I am so grateful because I learn a ton from you, David. Like, you are this like intellectual textbook, and you teach me all kinds of things. I think one thing that I'm really struggling with on this topic is like feeling powerless.
Yeah.
What would you say? Like, I'm just fascinated to hear your perspective on that. Like, what would you say to someone like me who's like, well, like we need to have change, but how do I even go back about making a difference in this system that is clearly so messed up?
Yeah. Well, so this is one of the pillar issues that need to be at the forefront of every single vote and policy decision that every single person makes in their daily lives. So racism being number one, Black Lives Matter and all, you know, supporting all minorities, and two, gun laws. And three is climate change. So, but we start with the humans and then go from there. And, you know, this destruction that we're seeing constantly, it's not that it requires, okay, we're rewriting the Constitution. All it requires is a reasonable read of that. And every legal scholar worth a damn that isn't just coming from a policy perspective where they're in NRA's pocket would say, okay, this is not what was intended. No one thought that the Constitution should mean this. And it would be so easy to take the next step. And I mean, to end this on a hopeful note, I think that the next step is coming. I think that the carnage that we're seeing in so many different places isn't a hopeless position right now. I think that what has happened in the last year with public perceptions changing so quickly on topics that really matter is what can happen with gun control. You know, you're talking about the American Medical Association coming out and being like, okay, we need common sense gun laws now.
Actually, I was going to say, so for me, I really draw onto like concrete, like when you say next steps, it's like, I want to know like, what are the concrete next steps? Like, I don't like thinking in these like big amorphous terms. And I love what the American Medical Association did. So they essentially outlined a few different policies that have to happen to make this better. So one being opposing private ownership of assault weapons, two requiring licensing and permitting, three stronger background checks, and four restraining orders against gun ownership. And I love that they're just like putting these like concrete steps in place. And to me, like my brain really aligns with that fact of like, okay, like I want to make change, but I also really want to know like what are the next steps in making change.
Yeah. And the Second Amendment is not about freedom. Freedom is to be able to go to the grocery store and not get shot. or not have to worry if you're an Asian person all the time worrying about Asian hate and what's going to happen to you at, you know, your job or whatever, what we've heard from athletes. The Second Amendment right now is the opposite of democratic. It's something that codifies power in the few, in the people where power has always been. So rethinking what that means is not a hard thing to do. It is very easy in terms of making the policies. The hard part is getting the empathy, the basic human empathy to do that. And I'm really hopeful that we're moving in that direction.
I feel like we need some music here for this transition. Maybe you can do some rap or something. What's the first 30 seconds of Where the Party At?
Jagged Edge, Where the Party At? We're going to talk a little bit about why we get nervous before doing these podcasts. I actually get really warm and sweaty because we try to talk about everything. And sometimes, we mess up.
Do you still get nervous for these podcasts?
Always.
It's funny because I actually don't get nervous for these podcasts anymore. No, it's funny because I get very nervous for public speaking. Presentation's not my jam. We've talked about this on here before. But I love these podcasts. I think maybe it's because of all the engagement we've gotten from our listeners. Yeah. I just feel like there's this vibe of love and positive reflection and empathy coming back from our community. Yeah. And I'm just feeling that when I podcast.
I'm just imagining thousands of people just nodding their heads in the front row.
Oh, I'm picturing thousands of Leslie Knopes just out there being you're my Galentine today, girl.
I am such a big fan of that. The liberation to talk about topics that we're not even experts on is really cool. And, it reminds me actually of you at the start line of races. So Megan preparing a start line for races, she's the biggest expert I've ever seen. And she has preached this method around the world of how to pee at start lines.
So I am an extremely efficient peer. Yeah. So the method, actually, it's funny because Trail Runner Magazine came to me and they're like, oh, do you want to write a method on this? And I was like, it was actually the first time I've turned down writing an article. Because I was like, when you Google my name, I don't want to see really efficient ways to pee while still wearing your shorts. Probably not great for someone in the medical world.
The American Medical Association would definitely
They'd be like,
that.
We don't know about that one. But so essentially, yeah. So I have mastered this art of efficient peeing.
Every woman on the line, listen up, because this is life-changing. Many people on the team have told us that this is the way to go.
Actually, the first step, though, I think there is some PT exercises, some prehab that's required for this. I think Kegels and having appropriate bladder control is actually very helpful in this. But you can essentially gather up your shorts and move them to the side and then move one leg to the side and create this space in which it's very easy to pee while still wearing your shorts. And I do that quite
often. So sometimes
I get sad when I'm wearing half tights. I'm like, oh, I've wrecked my pee mechanism today. So if I have the choice between shorts and half tights, I'll usually go shorts because of the ease of peeing.
That's actually so funny because I remember sometimes at start lines of races, you'll be there and we'll be talking and all of a sudden I'll see your eyes just start to squint a little bit. And I can tell that in your head, you're going, and I look down and just a slight trickle is coming out. And a couple times you've raced in half tights and I'll look down and I'll just see a wet spot.
That's not true.
I think
it's sweat.
Definitely sweat.
It's for sure sweat. But it's funny because I often get nerves before races, but I think what's fascinating to me is they kind of all disappear once I get in the start line. There's just all of a sudden, my eyes are going into tunnel vision. I'm it's ready to go. It's time to pee. I'm getting in this focus. So the pee is kind of my initiation that it's ready to go.
So thank you all for your love in this process, especially as we tackle things guns and stuff that we're just learning. And we're going to try to do that throughout on every topic. This is episode 41, which is going to be the Pete Holmes episode, one of my ultimate idols, comedian that's freaking amazing. We were introduced to him from the television show Crashing on HBO. If you haven't seen it, you can go back and watch it. It's freaking awesome. And what struck me is the very first episode is him as Pete Holmes in a semi-autobiographical way, walking in and getting cheated on by his wife, walking in on the act.
And that's the tone for the entire series. Actually, the hardest I've ever laughed is in the final show of season one during the baptism scene. I'm pretty sure that's the hardest I've ever laughed in a TV show before.
Yeah, and it was such a good metaphor for rebirth after this breakdown. And that gets back to Pete's life more generally. He wrote this amazing book called Comedy Sex God that we recommend. So he grew up in an evangelical house. He wanted to be a youth pastor. He was really defined by his religious upbringing. But what did that create in him was this extreme sense, this deep-seated sense of shame, particularly about his body, particularly about his hormone monster, as the show Big Mouth would call it, You know, every time that he masturbated, he's like, I feel like God is watching me right now. And he would feel so much shame. And then he would say after the fact that it almost made it more titillating. It made it like this forbidden fruit. And so he would go in these cycles of like masturbating and then feeling shame and then getting turned on by that same thing. And you think about what you're doing to a kid when that happens. And it created this brain that was like a magical like cornucopia of amazing ideas.
I think what's fascinating though, and Crashing really emphasizes this, and he goes into this in his book, Comedy, Sex, God, is that divorce really made him contemplate his faith. Yeah. Divorce plus mushrooms. There's that caveat there. The mushrooms are probably
psychedelics pretty important. Definitely helped.
Definitely important in that. But I think like he came out of that with like, as he was like reevaluating his faith, with a sense of curiosity and wonder that I think is just so fascinating. And I think he applied that too. So he talks very openly. Like if you listen to us, I've sometimes like, we've actually driven from Colorado to California listening to his podcast, and we'll be driving and like listening to like bonkers things that he's saying. And we're like driving like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's saying this right now. Like he's just a very open person. And I love how he like, he really tries to talk openly about that, because like he has been existing in this shameful place for so long in life, and that so he's like trying to re-own that.
He lost his faith through something that was extreme trauma, because it wasn't just divorce. It was tearing down everything he thought about existence. And what built back was this full openness, because once you're left with nothing, that's the ultimate opportunity, as we're going to get into in like a training topic later. And like, he's a great example of that.
And he's so open about sex. I actually found, so he did an interview, believe it or not, with Playboy and whatever. I mean, it's a long interview, but it's actually a fantastic Q&A. Now, this is probably the first time I've ever read Playboy, was preparing for this podcast.
It's also the first time I've ever read Playboy.
But so this was an amazing quote that he said on just being open and honest. I'm trying to say that you are part of the natural flow of the universe, and sex is a part of that. I have a jerk right now where I say the universe is itself erotic. It's attracted to itself. It's called the Big Bang, for fuck's sake. It's not polite. It's ejaculatory. It's this huge explosive orgasm that we are part of. And through wrong interpretation of a few Bible verses and some good old-fashioned puritanical Western shame, we've sort of lost the narrative. So to show that people want to feel okay by themselves, I'm trying to demonstrate that by saying, I'm not embarrassed. I'm going to be open.
Yeah.
That was like one of my favorite all-time quotes.
Mainly because of the line about the Big Bang.
Oh, that was the game-changing for me.
Banging is our favorite one. I made Megan quesadillas before this podcast, and she's like, you just banged my taste buds.
Actually, no. I was taking a nap, and then all of a sudden I wake up from the nap to just this like aromatic wafts of goodness throughout the house, and you were making me quesadillas, and it was like the exact food I wanted in the moment, and my mind was just like, what the fuck just happened?
Well, you earned it, because I had some stomach pains last night, and Megan nursed me back to health when I was going through some rough moments. And so what Pete shows is that like this journey through the darkest depths creates this opportunity to open up to the whole world, and that like dogma and religion and all these things that are designed to create like a spiritual grounding, a reason for morality, don't necessarily need to come from someone watching you and shaking their finger that you're doing something wrong. It can come from a place of being like, we are loved just for being, like this universal connectedness. And he emphasizes that in everything. And perhaps most poignantly for me, he grounds it all not in ideas of God, but in the idea of death and impermanence. So if you've read our book, you know that our first line is, every runner has the same finish line, death.
And talk about the fact of like impermanence. So his show Crashing actually came to an end early. So they had, I think, 3 seasons of Crashing, and then it got canceled. And for him, that's like considered a big failure.
Yeah.
And I think you can talk openly about oneness. You can talk openly about curiosity and wonder and being supportive of others. But like what truly happens when shit hits the fan is a test of that. And he responded to that with like such amazing grace. And, you know, he just really emphasized, he's like, I am so grateful for everything that I got to do with HBO through the series Crashing, and like, you know, just recognizing the value that that had in his life. And he's like, yeah, I experienced emotions. It was hard, but like I brought this like full gratitude and this full curiosity and this full wonder into this show. And it truly made it like part of this journey and remarkable by itself.
And so I'm motivated so many things, like his sense of wonder and curiosity, and also the fact that when shit gets torn down, what builds back up can be full of light and hope and love. So if you're listening to this and you feel like things might be torn down, just know that.
Which I think is probably, this is 2021. So I feel like by definition, by statistics, it has to be a lot of people.
Oh yeah. And I mean, going through training logs today after what happened in Boulder, like, you know, we're seeing that everywhere. And it just gets back to the impermanence of all of this stuff is scary as hell. But in that fear, there's also something that we're all connected to, which is one, we're all connected to this impermanence, but two, we're all connected to this possibility, these open, infinite ability to like put ourselves out there and live and have empathy and like truly identify with other people going through the same journey.
So, and banging.
And banging. So let's get to topic one.
Is that a good transition for you?
We're definitely going to just end it right there.
Perfect. So topic one is actually on vaccine side effects. Perfect. So we've gotten a number of athletes ask questions related to this. MJ, AB, GE. Lots of people getting their
sounds
vaccines
like
right now.
A stock ticker.
Which is exciting. Yeah, right? Those stocks are going up. That's
yeah,
a GameStop right there.
So you got your vaccine last week. So we're going to start with like a personal anecdote.
Yeah, that was interesting. So I felt great, actually. No energy symptoms, no vaccine, no fever, no headache, none of that. I did have one very interesting symptom though.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
My lips swelled.
Yes.
Super weird.
So Megan comes down the stairs in the morning. I usually wake up first and she's just like, looks like a duck. I can't really emphasize how swollen these
lips are. They're my Jolie lips.
Yeah. They looked like two like oversized slugs just coming. You looked beautiful, but it was also a little bit jarring.
So that was my main side effect.
And then you posted it on Instagram.
The funny thing. So I posted on Instagram. Actually, as I posted, you're like, Megan, you only take selfies when your face is really fucked up. Yeah. I feel like I'm taking that as a compliment. I'm like, yeah, I'm not a selfie girl. I'll take that as a compliment.
That's so true.
But the super funny thing. So I posted on Instagram and made some joke about my lips being Angelina Jolie lips after the vaccine. And apparently, so people who have lip fillers, a side effect of the COVID vaccine, if you have lip fillers, is getting this lip swelling.
Oh my God.
So people on Instagram, I got like 8 DMs from people that were like, do you have lip fillers? I'm like, do you think I have lip fillers? I can barely brush my hair. There's no chance I have lip fillers.
You would have just like outed your plastic surgery. I feel like to fill those would take a lot of effort. I feel like there'd be other things we would all.
Well, I'm just confused too, because like, as I had these massive Jolie lips, like it was really hard to like drink coffee or eat. Like it just made, even speaking was kind of inconvenient. So I'm like, I just don't understand why you would fill your lips.
And I'm pretty sure we've demonstrated that we would have told everyone if you had filled your lips, it would have been a topic on the podcast. We were somehow worked it into a conversation about death and Cinnamon Toast Crunch. What we've seen with athletes is generally mirroring what Megan saw in her first dose. And so we're going to get a little bit into like how we want athletes to train. So what is your recommendation when you're talking about first dose and second dose of the vaccine?
So my recommendation is just erring on the side of caution. And I think also understanding too, from what we've seen in the research and then also what we've seen in our athletes, is every athlete is so different. Like people are going to respond very differently to vaccines. Actually, interestingly, women have stronger immune systems. And so many women are having more side effects to these vaccines.
Bullshit. Toxic masculinity. I have the best immune system.
And then also younger people too. So younger people have more robust immune systems and may mount these stronger immune responses and thus have stronger side effects. So we're just erring on the side of caution. So right now I'm giving all athletes a rest day after the first vaccine. And then after the second vaccine, which is where we're classically seeing more symptoms, either a rest day or multiple rest days, or a rest day followed by an aerobic build week, just kind of being flexible based on the athlete.
I think an interesting anecdote, again, you can't really trace outcome from the vaccine right now, but I had a pro athlete we coach who hadn't been injured in years, had a calf injury after a second dose. And I think it gets back to the idea that when we're talking about these immune responses, the very productive things the vaccines are looking to promote, we're also talking about a little bit of underlying cellular level stress. So we need to start balancing the stress. So if you're out there, really recommend strongly rest the day after the first dose, even if you feel fine. It's hard. And Megan was having trouble even with her swollen lips. She wanted to get out.
I got
there and
sad.
Run.
I was like, can I go out and run? I feel great today, David.
And then ease in with like an easy run the day after that and then get back to normal training based on how you feel. And then the second dose, rest for sure the second day, and then a rest or an easy run or easy activity the day after that. And then you can start to ease back in, but not to get right back to intensity, because that, you know, the couple injuries I have seen that could just be a total coincidence have been on workouts within the few days after vaccine.
I was going to say, I think the important thing to highlight too is that it's just a nonlinear process and it doesn't happen often sequentially. So I've had some athletes who get the vaccine and they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't imagine I'd feel great like within 4 hours.
Yeah.
But like within 4 hours, you're probably okay. So like, you know, I've seen some athletes get the vaccine, be totally fine for 36 hours and then all of a sudden have side effects. And so like the time scale may be different for every athlete too. And I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, it's totally worth whenever
symptoms come. Yes, please get the vaccine. Yeah. The vaccine is amazing. It's awesome. It's great for public health. Actually, something that interesting that I've seen is a lot of athletes right now are getting the vaccine through overflow measures, or, you know, like vaccine appointments are being canceled and they're on the wait list. And I've seen some shame in athletes who are like, well, like, should I be the person on this wait list? And my approach is, hey, we need to get the vaccine in as many people's arms right now as possible. And however you can get the vaccine, great. You know, don't lie about your occupation. Like, you know, take your appropriate weight in line. But like, if you're getting it through overflow, if you're getting it through volunteering in a clinic, that's fantastic. That's awesome. Celebrate that shit.
I was expecting you, what you should have done is just when you're in Walmart to get your vaccine, just like grabbed one for me.
Yeah, brought it home. Actually, I saw a really funny tweet of a guy who put writer down for his occupation under the COVID vaccine, and it came back and it said not valid. It's like, yeah, that was also the answer my mom gave me when I told her I was going to be writer. I thought that was super funny.
Our royalty checks likely agree. Awesome. Want to get to the next topic?
Let's do it.
This is on downtime. So this is the subject of the Toronto Magazine article this week. And the big takeaway here is that breaks make breakthroughs. If you have had to take time off or take downtime, that is a huge opportunity. And this article gets into the science of why that is. And we're going to go over it very quickly. You know, I think the hardest part here is when you have to take that downtime, there's a little voice in our head that says, we are so far back from where we are.
Actually, scratch that. That is a big freaking voice in our head that says that. I know whenever I have to take downtime, I have like an existential crisis for a few days. And I think it's very normal for athletes to have that feeling.
Yeah, because I think we all remember what it was like to first build fitness. And the thinking is, oh, well, I'm losing everything. I'm going back to square one. And that's not the way that aerobic development and speed and economy and all these things work over time. So, you know, the traditional path is you build fitness very quickly when you first start training in your life. And then it's slow progress from there with a lot of downs in the cycle. But if you have to take downtime, you don't go back to zero. You just go down a little bit. And it gets back down to the physiology that it's all very rapid to come back. So there was a 2021 article in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research on fitness maintenance that basically said, if you take athletes or take people and have them do 15 weeks of training, you can then have them take 15 weeks of just a session or two, and they're right at their same fitness level. Barely anything changes.
So you highlighted this in the Trail Runner Magazine article. I thought you did a fantastic job with the article, by the way. It was very complex. I love the way that you laid this out. I think very important caveat of this study, though, is the fact that it was done in untrained individuals. And you did a great job of saying like, hey, these principles are interesting. Now I'm going to go in and dive into the deeper research of how this may apply to athletes. And I thought you did a good job of that.
Megan's giving me a lot of credit. What happened was the editor, AKA Megan, was like, David, this isn't applying to like advanced athletes. And I was like, oh, you're exactly right. I need to change it. She totally banged the editing process. So when you're thinking about the variables that matter, VO2 max goes down a little bit after a couple of weeks, but it also comes back within a week. So it's always right there. Blood volume.
Within a week or within a couple of weeks?
A couple of weeks of intensity or a couple of weeks of consistency, a week of intensity after that. Blood volume and stroke output. So how the heart moves blood through the body, both decrease very rapidly. And that's kind of that feeling you have where you feel underwater when you return. But they also increase very rapidly. One study from the Journal of Applied Physiology in 2015 found a 17.8% increase in blood volume after 4 days.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. So these things are very, we feel like we lose a lot, but we actually don't. The body's right at the surface.
The principles that I love that you outlined were the neuromuscular and biomechanical changes that happen. So thinking about the body getting more efficient and then being able to get back to that place of efficiency. The other thing too is the muscular changes that go on. So I think this is so cool. So once you have these like complex muscular changes that happen, you maintain those muscular nuclei so the research thinks.
Yeah.
So that you can like better access those nuclei at later points. I love that point. Like the idea of like maintaining nuclei to me is so cool. So I'm like, wait, do I have nuclei when I was a field hockey player? Am I going to be really good at like the shuffle run again?
Your butt has so many nuclei. Dude, that's like the best rap song. That needs to be our rap song.
I would totally rap
that. Girl, your butt has nuclei.
Oh, yeah.
And boy, your butt has nuclei and non-binary people.
I like big nuclei and I can't lie.
Whoa, and it rhymes. Dude, this is amazing. And that's just with regaining your fitness. The big thing about the article is that going beyond where you ever were before is possible too. And we'll just brush over a couple of the points. One is long-term recovery from chronic stress. So there's long stress tails on a number of different biomarkers, all of which may take longer periods of time off. Number two is the nervous system. You think about overtraining syndrome. You can't run your way through overtraining syndrome. Usually you just have to take time off. Even if you don't have overtraining syndrome, there's probably nervous system resets that are aided by these periods of time.
The other thing that I love too, thinking about is the endocrine system. So thinking about about the changes that happen and the overall boost that happens to testosterone, estrogen levels, cortisol levels, and then the downstream impacts that those have on things like bones for females. I'm thinking about like optimizing if a female hasn't had regular menstrual cycles, like these breakthrough periods or these down periods may be great times to help like reestablish that.
Yeah. So our brains, I think, really work on short time cycles. Like if I've taken 3 days off, I feel like a slug. I am terrible. I feel like Megan's lips, just two big slugs. But in reality, our bodies are working on much longer timescales. You might lose a little bit, that all is right there and comes back very quickly if you just give it a little bit of patience.
It's funny as you say that, because I'm just like, I think about myself and I totally have short-term memory loss when it comes to this. Like I know the science, I know the research, but it's so hard for me to conceptualize this.
Yeah, I think it's never something that will feel totally natural. It's one of those things that you just remind yourself over and over and over again. Kind of like when the voice starts screaming, like, hey voice, let's just chill out a little bit. This will be okay. And you know, it could also be really complex things like gene expression and epigenetics. So when you start to turn these switches on and off and on and off, it's almost like I used to have a Dell PC that would make a lot of weird creaking noises. And I just learned that if it started doing that, just turn it off. And sometimes when you turned it back on, everything was okay.
If we could play a drinking game with turn it back on and epigenetics, we could have our podcast listeners very drunk across a couple of episodes.
Yeah. And you know, we see this all the time in coaching. You see it all the time in athletics across every single sport, is that these periods of downtime, whether it's planned, whether it's a pregnancy, whether it's a terrible injury, whatever it is, lead to these incredible places way beyond what they ever could have seen. And I think it's because sometimes those long-term slow trajectories that we see are actually stagnation, and breaking the cycle, turning it off and turning it back on causes that rapid progress process that is so important.
Summary point, don't be afraid to turn it back on.
Woohoo, we love you guys.
Thanks, everyone.